Word, I'm gonna say the word.
In the beginning was the word.
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 Was the word.
From the studios of KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona, welcome to Word, a podcast about literature. Here's your host, Tom Maxedon.
Coming up on this episode of Word, a frank discussion about the intersection of evangelicalism and politics.
As a journalist, when I see something happening, I want to write about it. I want to pay attention to it. And this was something that I happen to know quite a lot about firsthand.
We'll talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals. Plus, our spotlight on National Poetry Month continues.
The next time someone tells you our people were illiterate, teach them about our visual literacies, our ability to read the intertextual sacredness of all things.
We'll catch up with Professor Craig Santos Perez, winner of the National Book Award for Poetry. But first, we turn our attention to another poet, Hiromi Yoshida, who's based in Bloomington, Indiana. Her 2023 poem, Father of Icarus, is part of an upcoming collection. Unfortunately, technology limitations prevented us from capturing a viable reading of it in her own words. So we enlisted KBOC classical host Greg Kostraba to do so with her permission.
Father of Icarus by Hiromi Yoshida. He sees his son soaring sunward, while he himself flies steadily parallel with the horizon, observing the middle ground. Glimpse of gold in the corner of his weary eye, suddenly green and frothy, and a dappled splash below. The coin-sized sun's reflection rippling, blooming into a sea-green rose, that sad place where his son fell. The boy had slipped from his cunning, dexterous hands like Pasiphae's loose-limbed doll. Icarus was the jointed, anointed one, a vague smudge on an oily canvas, his pasty white feet, its paintless speck, that waxy residue in bloodshot eyes. Daedalus lands on the sunless coast, folding away his makeshift wings, stroking his briny beard, dreaming of gathering the green roses that bloomed where his son had made that big splash without his consent.
That was Father of Icarus by Hiromi Yoshida. It's steeped in classical mythology and reminded me of a famous poem by W.H. Auden called Musée des Beaux-Arts. His is a kind of commentary on the painting Landscape with the Fall of Icarus by celebrated Flemish painter Peter Bruegel the Elder. It depicts the demise of the boy whose wax wings melted when he flew too close to the sun and plunged into the ocean. Thankfully, I was able to capture a snippet of my discussion with Yoshida about her poem, starting with my curiosity if she was inspired by Auden or the painting when she wrote it.
That was a poem that we studied in high school, and that was a long time ago. And I think it might have kind of stuck in my head since then. So maybe on a deeper unconscious level, it was kind of like the subtext or the inspiration for my Icarus poems. But when I did write Father of Icarus and my other Icarus poems, I wasn't consciously thinking about that poem. It's really hard to tell.
Or at least inspired by the painting by Peter Bruegel, who was, you know, one of the old masters, just because of some of the imagery that you use, you know, the suddenly green and frothy dappled splash below. It's a really, really beautiful poem. You can't just be a casual reader and come to this poem, I don't think. I think you've got to do some digging. Is my perception about that correct?
Maybe not an extreme amount of digging. As long as you know what Icarus is, generally speaking, I think the poem is quite accessible to the average reader without additional information.
Hiromi Yoshida is author of Father of Icarus. It's a poem that's going to be contained in an upcoming collection due out in October. And Hiromi, I want to thank you so much for coming to Word.
And thank you, too.
You can read the poem Father of Icarus from her upcoming collection Green Roses Bloom for Icarus. And also find out a bit more about poet Hiromi Yoshida on our website, word.kjzz.org. Coming up, a frank discussion with NPR's Sarah McCammon about the intersection of evangelicalism and politics. I'm Tom Maxedon, and you're listening to Word, a KJZZ podcast about literature.
Heart of the Arts is your connection to the exciting classical art scene. I'm KBOX Greg Kostraba, and I interview some of today's top classical musicians, both here in the Valley and beyond. Subscribe to the podcast or listen on demand at heartofthearts.kbox.org to access these interviews. That's heartofthearts.kbox.org.
Hey, I'm A. Martinez from Morning Edition.
And I'm Phil Latzman from Morning Edition on KJZZ.
We start our days early, really early, so you have the news you need to start your day.
Later, we take over. I'm Juana Summers from All Things Considered.
And I'm Tiara Vian from All Things Considered on 91.5.
Ease into your evening with us with updates on the biggest stories of the day
and the latest in music, arts, and science.
Listen to KJZZ 91.5 every weekday.
Welcome back to Word. I'm Tom Maxidon. NPR national political correspondent and co-host of NPR's politics podcast, Sarah McCammon, has a new book titled The Ex-Vangelicals. It's a mashup of memoir and investigative reporting that examines the intersection of evangelicalism and politics, as well as McCammon's own faith journey as a member of an evangelical community. Listeners should note that the sentiments and opinions expressed in my following discussion with McCammon do not reflect those of KJZZ, its editorial staff, management, nor the Maricopa County Community College District, which holds the license for KJZZ. Therefore, I wanted McCammon to do most of the talking in an in-her-own-word-style conversation with brief questions by me. At the outset of our convo, I disclosed to her that I grew up in the United Methodist faith. So I started by asking her about the origin story of the term ex-evangelicals.
I first came across the term ex-evangelical as the 2016 campaign was winding down. I'd been covering the Republican primary and then the general election and the Trump campaign during that time. And I had done a lot of stories about white evangelicals, which happens to be the world I came from. Coincidentally, it wasn't something I went looking for, but I found myself assigned to cover that campaign, and that was kind of the story. And I was fascinated by the discussion around where white evangelicalism was going and had gone. It had been really 15 years or so since I had been in the thick of a white evangelical community, but it very much shaped me, and it was the world that I knew. So I felt like I was sort of observing things both as a professional, as a journalist, and also with the context of my own personal background. But one of the stories I did was about white evangelical women who were struggling with Donald Trump's language about women and his behavior toward women, and struggling with the evangelical embrace of his movement. And one of the people we interviewed for that story used the word ex-evangelical. She said, you know, some of us think of ourselves not really as evangelical anymore. We don't want that label. We think of ourselves as ex-evangelical. And I thought it was an interesting way of putting it because, you know, I had my own sort of journey, complicated journey with my background. And there were things along the way, which I write about in the book, that created a sense of cognitive dissonance for me that didn't feel, that just didn't feel like the place for me to be sort of spiritually. And I was on my own, on my journey, you know, with that. And then here I was listening to people in this moment where evangelicalism was really in the spotlight, kind of wrestling publicly with their own faith, right, and their relationship with it. And so I started kind of paying attention to some of these ex-evangelical circles on social media and really discovered that there was a huge and growing dialogue going on around this idea of emerging from an evangelical background. And more broadly, even around this idea of deconstruction, a related idea, which is sort of rethinking one's religious background. So you say you grew up Methodist. I think people who grew up in sort of tight-knit religious communities often have to go through this process of rethinking what it means to them. And, you know, the world that I know that I come from is evangelicalism. And I felt like something was happening and I wanted to write about it.
One of the things I'm always curious about when journalists write books is, of course, this is part memoir, but also investigative journalism. And we're taught not to become the story. But of course, this is a different approach. What struggles did you encounter balancing your strong reporting skills while giving people an understanding of your own story in this book?
You know, this is something that I wrestled with so much in even deciding whether or not I wanted to write a book like this. In 2017, fresh off covering the campaign, a lot of people said, well, you should write about what you experienced. And a lot of people wanted to know, who knew about my own background, like, what do you see in this movement? How do you explain evangelicals? How do you explain their support for Trump? What is this all about? And I found myself, you know, at speaking engagements, being asked these kinds of questions. And you know, I struggled with it because I did have that question. I'm a journalist. I believe in trying to be fair and not make yourself the story. And yet I found, you know, again, that kind of accidentally I was in the middle of the story. And so I spent really several years thinking about this and taking notes and journaling and reflecting on my own history and paying attention to these conversations that were happening online. And I just came to the feeling really around the January 6th attack on the Capitol, when people walked into the Capitol with crosses and signs that said Jesus saves. I knew that there was sort of a rising Christian nationalism that was closely linked to the Trump movement, but I hadn't been sure if I wanted to say anything about it from my perspective as someone who grew up in that world. But at that moment, it kind of felt like it was being said for me. I didn't need to connect the dots. They were being connected quite explicitly in signs people were carrying into the U.S. Capitol. And so that was kind of the moment. I had been thinking more and more about it, but I decided that, yeah, I want to do this. And so, you know, I was seeing so much self-reflection going on among the evangelical community, some of it around Trump, but some of it around lots of other issues, you know, the relationship between the evangelical church and science, or around issues of race, certainly, sexuality. There were so many kind of tension points and sources of cognitive dissonance that people were discussing that had nothing directly to do with Donald Trump, but it kind of felt like a catalyzing moment for these conversations. And as a journalist, when I see something happening, I want to write about it. I want to pay attention to it. And this was something that I happened to know, you know, quite a lot about firsthand. So that was how I kind of arrived at the decision both to do this book and to do it the way I did it, which is my own story in conversation with lots of other people's stories and a lot of research.
And of course, we heard stories about journalists just being treated horribly by folks at rallies. And I'm also kind of curious as to one of the reasons why you may have written the book as a way to sort of get buy-in from those throngs of people that treated you and others so horribly for just doing your job.
I would say that the main audience for this book is, there's two main audiences. One is people who know nothing about evangelicalism, have no real tie to it, but want to understand it, find themselves mystified by its hold on the Republican Party and the culture at large. And the second is people like me with some kind of history in evangelicalism who are either wrestling with it, thinking it through, trying to make sense of it. But, you know, at least that's what I thought at the outset. But to your point, I do hope that people who are within these communities, some of them will read this book with an open mind, because in the course of doing this research and just in talking to friends and others who have a similar background, the thing that I've observed is that I think for those within evangelical churches, there is a sense of anger, frustration, confusion about why so many people are disaffiliating from their churches. And and sometimes there's a lot of, I think, resentment and tension. And we've seen, I write about some of the pastors who've spoken out publicly against the idea of deconstruction. But I hope that some evangelicals will read it with an open mind and maybe try to get a better sense of what it is that's driving people to wrestle with their faith and their religious background in this way. I think that if there's anything I know to be true, it's not about wanting to offend or upset or anger anyone from the community. It's about trying to live authentically and make sense of the world as it is. You talk about buy-in, and to the extent that I'm looking for anything, I think I just hope that people will read it with an open mind.
Well, and also I was going to say, I felt like by the end, you arrived at a place of peace. In a way, what I picked up on was this notion of, look, we didn't leave the evangelical church. They left us. Am I right, at least in part, on that feeling?
Certainly for a lot of people. I hear that sentiment a lot, and I see it a lot in some of these spaces. You know, the sense that if you grow up evangelical, one of the things you're taught is to pursue truth and to pursue kindness and love and justice. And for a lot of people, that means accepting the reality about For example, something like the age of the earth. It means loving your neighbor, whether that neighbor is gay or straight, whether they're Christian or Muslim or nothing, you know? And I think for a lot of people, the values that they were taught in their churches, they internalized them and applied them in a way that maybe their pastors and teachers and parents wouldn't have wanted them to, but they're nonetheless authentically and genuinely applying them. And to me, that's the power of a complex religious faith. It sort of gets inside you and you synthesize it along with all of your experiences and your personality. And it can get inside you and you internalize it and you kind of transform it and adapt it to the world that you live in. You know, we all have to go forward in the world as it is, not the world that necessarily we grew up in. And so for me, I think I have found increasingly a place of peace about it. But that looks very different than maybe I would have thought it would look when I was a child.
NPR's Sarah McCammon is author of The Exvangelicals. Sarah, I want to thank you so much for coming and talking to us about this book.
Thank you so much.
You can find out a bit more about NPR national political correspondent and co-host of NPR's politics podcast, Sarah McCammon, as well as her new book on our website. Just go to word.kjzz.org. Coming up, we'll talk with the winner of the National Book Award for Poetry, who's originally from Guam. I'm Tom Maxidon, and you're listening to Word, a KJZZ podcast about literature.
Need a break from the news? Need some inspiration while you work? You need some jazz. Listen to the new Jazz PHX at jazzphx.org. It's your home for jazz in Phoenix with our local hosts and the best new and classic artists. Give it a listen at jazzphx.org.
Did you know 2 out of every 3 NPR listeners prefer to purchase products and services from public radio sponsors? You can see the benefits of becoming a KJZZ corporate sponsor at sponsor.kjzz.org.
Rio Salado College is proud to offer affordable online bachelor's degrees in high-demand fields such as teaching and public safety administration. Invest in your education and career without financial burden. More information at riosalado.edu.
Welcome back to Word. I'm Tom Maxidon. As we close out our celebration of National Poetry Month, we welcome poet Craig Santos Perez. He's a professor and the winner of the National Book Award for Poetry, which was presented to him late last year by the National Book Foundation. From Unincorporated Territory, Amat is the 5th poetry collection by Perez, who originally hails from Guam, the U.S. territory in the Western Pacific. As a former decade-long resident there myself, I opened our recent convo with a familiar island greeting.
Buenas and half a day, Craig.
Half a day, Tom. How's it going?
It's going well. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I'm glad we were finally able to connect.
Yeah, man. Gosh, what a ride. You must be exhausted.
It's been a crazy couple of months, but I appreciate your patience and support.
No worries. And congratulations on the National Book Award. How do you feel?
I'm still in shock, to be honest, but it was, of course, a great honor, and I'm really grateful to the National Book Foundation.
You certainly look like it in the ceremony. If we were talking to folks maybe who watch an awards ceremony like the Academy Awards or something, you know, and some of the actors kind of think, okay, well, I got this in the bag, right? But you were blown away, weren't you?
I was, and they told all of us to prepare an acceptance speech beforehand because, you know, all of us had an equal chance of winning, but I honestly did not think I would have won, so I didn't prepare anything.
Well, I mean, you couldn't tell that from the ceremony. You're great as an extemporaneous speaker. What was going through your mind? Who were you thinking about when that was announced?
I was sitting next to my mom and my partner, and, you know, when it was announced, my picture and book came up on the big screen. I just stared at it. So my partner was like, you have to get up now and go accept the award. And so I was, you know, in that moment, I was just completely in shock and couldn't believe it.
Gosh, I'm trying to remember how long it's been. It's definitely around the COVID era when things started, when we last talked to you, and a lot has happened. But I wanted to remind folks who didn't have a chance to hear that episode, when your love for poetry first developed, how did that get started for you?
You know, I've always loved reading and literature and stories growing up, but it really wasn't until high school where I started writing poetry, studying poetry in class, and was even a editor of my high school as a literary journal. And so it was during that time where I really, you know, connected to poetry and found it to be a space for me to express myself.
But when did you think, hey, in terms of just expressing myself, this is an avenue that I could sort of stroll down and have a discussion about some really important issues in a larger way, not just writing for myself, but maybe writing for myself and others to connect to?
Yeah, that really happened when I was a graduate student in the Master's of Fine Arts program in creative writing at the University of San Francisco. And I was 24 years old, and you know, I wanted to give myself the opportunity and space to actually write a book and spend 2 years just telling the stories of my homeland and my native culture. And, you know, it was that point where I was, you know, felt like, you know, the power of poetry could really, you know, create a new life for me.
This is your fifth collection. It's called From Unincorporated Territory, Amat. And I don't think most people even understand, first of all, what is a U.S. territory. So maybe we could start there. This means things like not having a voting member to the U.S. Congress, being disenfranchised in federal elections, especially for president. But what else for you?
Yeah, so for those who don't know, Guam has been a U.S. territory since 1898. And our official designation is an unincorporated territory, as opposed to a state, which is an incorporated territory into the nation. And being unincorporated, you know, partly means exactly what you said, is that we don't enjoy all the rights and privileges as those who reside in the states. And it creates a very neo-colonial relationship between, you know, the territory and the federal government. And so growing up in that space, it felt very palpable, kind of the colonial situation that I grew up in, and really formed the foundation, a lot of the politics that I write about.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't think people even understand things like getting items to Guam via the Jones Act and the artificial inflation that comes along with that, that territories have to face. I mean, when you're paying $12 for a gallon of orange juice, for instance.
Yes, indeed. So it does create, you know, all these, you know, interesting, strange, and dissonant situations for those on Guam. And of course, we are U.S. citizens, but, you know, as I mentioned, we have a different experience of that citizenship than those who live in the states. And some of them are quite severe, as you said, kind of the high costs of food and fuel. But sometimes it's even more, you know, almost humorous, where, you know, we're used to Super Bowl Sunday, but of course on Guam, Super Bowl happens on Monday, right? Since it's across the international dateline. And so there are, you know, both small things that, you know, big things that make living in a territory different from living in the states.
Yeah, funny aside to that, I used to work for one of the major telecommunications companies there. And when new folks would transition in, they would get so angry and call us on their traditional Super Bowl Sunday and wonder why the game wasn't on. Well, because it hasn't physically happened in time, right? All kidding aside, Amat means medicine in Chamorro, the indigenous culture of Guam. How did you mean it in the title for your collection of poetry?
Yeah, so in all of my books in this series, they have a Chamorro name. And for this collection, I was thinking a lot about healing and how do we heal from some of the historical traumas that we've experienced through colonialism and militarism. And then how can we, you know, find certain parts of our culture that can heal us? And, you know, I was also thinking about traditional herbs and medicine that is used in Guam, that traditional healers will, you know, prescribe to us if we're feeling sick or if we have wounds. And even those are threatened with the military buildup on Guam that is destroying, you know, many of the plants and trees and jungles where the traditional healers will gather their medicine. So I was thinking both about medicine in terms of, you know, its materiality, but also kind of its symbolic meanings. Throughout the book, I try to offer various kinds of medicine, whether it be food, family, kind of cultural revitalization, native language, and so on, that I feel can give our people a sense of dignity, pride, and of course, healing.
And also you really address environmental injustice as well.
Yes, and that's a big part of, you know, the experience growing up on Guam and, you know, living in the islands in general, is that there are so many instances and examples of environmental injustice in our history. I already mentioned kind of militarism and colonialism, but another industry that impacts Guam is tourism, which also is a very polluting industry. And so many of our lands and waters, you know, have experienced, you know, decades of contamination. And as a result, a lot of those toxins have also entered the bodies of our people. So we have really high rates of cancer and other diseases. And so that's a kind of a core theme that I write about, something that I want to expose and critique throughout my work.
Did you want to read a selection from the work? I just wanted to offer you some space to read a poem of your choosing.
Sure, thank you. I always enjoy sharing the last poem in the book. It's called Ars Pacifica, and it's a kind of a statement on Pacific arts. And kind of the trigger of this poem happened in 2010 when I returned back to Guam with the publication of my second book. And I got to visit several public high schools and kind of read from the poems and engage with the students. And so there was one moment I had with a student that really profoundly impacted me. And so kind of forms the core of this poem. Ars Pacifica. I return home for the first time after 15 years away and visit an English class at one of Guam's public high schools. As I read aloud from my new book, I notice a student crying. "What's wrong?" I ask. She says, "I've never seen our culture in a book before. I just thought we weren't worthy of literature." How many young islanders have dived into the depths of a book only to find bleached coral and emptiness? We were taught that missionaries were the first readers in the Pacific because they could decipher the strange signs of the Bible. We were taught that missionaries were the first authors because they possessed the authority of written words. Today, studies show that Islander students read and write below grade level. It's natural, experts claim. Your ancestors were an illiterate, oral people. Don't believe their claims. Our ancestors deciphered signs in nature, interpreted star formations and sun positions, cloud and wind patterns, wave currents, and ocean efflorescence. That's why Master Navigator Papa Mal once said, quote, "If you can read the ocean, you will never be lost," end quote. Now let me tell you about Pacific written traditions, how our ancestors tattooed their skin with defiant scripts of intricately inked genealogies, how they carved epics into hard wood with sharpened points, their hands, and the pressure and responsibility of memory, how they stenciled petroglyphic lyrics on cave walls with clay, fire, and smoke. So the next time someone tells you our people were illiterate, teach them about our visual literacies, our ability to read the intertextual sacredness of all things. And always remember, if we can write the ocean, we will never be silenced.
Thank you so much for reading that. And it's just such powerful word interplay when you talk about reading the ocean, reading the landscape. You know, I've had discussions with folks from indigenous tribes in the state of Arizona who are in the creative landscape. And they talk about this similar concept of getting their language, let's say it might be Diné, for instance, into print, and how powerful that is for folks to see that and to be included in a literary landscape.
Yes, indeed. I feel this is common across indigenous cultures, you know, both the power of the written word once we wield it, But then also to acknowledge that, we had literacy even prior to written language. And sometimes a stereotype about Native people is that, you know, our ancestors were simply oral peoples, and that's how we passed down stories. But of course, as we know, there were so many other ways that our peoples told stories. And of course, so many ways that we practice literacy, whether it be reading the ocean or the land and the animals and so on. So I've always been inspired by kind of just the rich legacy of indigenous literacies, whether they be oral or written.
From unincorporated territory, Amat is the latest from Craig Santos Perez. It's the winner of the National Book Award for Poetry. Craig, Sitsitsmaase, thank you so much for coming to Word.
Sitsitsmaase, Tom. Thank you so much for having me.
You can find out a bit more about Craig Santos Perez and his new award-winning collection of poetry on our website, word.kjzz.org. We are back in May with more entertaining and thought-provoking literary convos. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening to KJZZ's Word Podcast about literature and also for supporting public radio. I'm Tom Maxinon.
Word.
Word?
Word.
Was the word.
Thanks for listening to Word, a KJZZ podcast about literature. You can find all episodes online at word.kjzz.org or wherever you get your podcasts.